Good afternoon and welcome to our first town hall meeting. I'm Michael D. Brown and I'm a candidate for city council. Please stay with us for a minute while we bring in our moderator, Kathleen Gomez, who will lead the discussion today. We hope that you'll call in and join in the discussion and ask us questions or Skype us at BBS Radio 2. Because we want to hear what you have to say, and that's what this is about. It's all about you. Are you there, Kathleen? Well, Kathleen hasn't come in yet, so let me start.
Hello, Ken and Michael Brown.
Hey, how are you?
I'm very good, and you?
Good. We're having a few technical problems this morning, but hopefully we'll get this thing off the ground. Go ahead, Kathleen.
Well, good afternoon, everyone who's listening, and welcome to the first in a series of 5 town hall meetings with candidate for D.C. City Council at Large, Michael D. Brown. I'm your moderator, Kathleen Gomez, and I am here to facilitate the conversation, propose questions to the candidate, and make sure these town hall meetings provide the kind of information you need to make an informed choice in the upcoming November election for D.C. City Council. These town hall meetings are designed to give you, the voter, the opportunity to call in and have your concerns addressed by the candidate, your questions answered, and your voice heard on the issues that are most important to you and to our city. We hope you will join in the discussion by calling in at 888-429-5471, or you can Skype your questions to BBS Radio 2. Esperamos que va a participar en la discusión. Llamado a 888-429-5471 o puede Skype sus preguntas a BBS Radio 2. Each town hall meeting will be conducted on this internet platform for an hour on the next 5 consecutive Sundays at 2 p.m. They will each deal with a different topic, and the final one will be on Sunday, October the 19th, and will be an open forum. So any of the things that you have listed or any other questions or any other subjects that we may not have touched upon, you will be able to ask during that open forum. Today's discussion, we're going to focus on education in the district. Very, very crucial issue. I would like to point out, however, that you are always free to ask a question on whatever issue is most important to you. I will take as many questions as possible, and I reserve the right to limit the time to ask or answer any one question. If we do have a lot of callers, I will try to keep people's comments to a minute or two. Let me point out that any question that remains unanswered at the end of the meeting can be submitted to the website, which is www.michaeldbrown2014.com. Now, let me introduce, I think he's already probably come online while we were having a little difficulty, is Michael D. Brown for an opening statement. Good afternoon, Mr. Brown, and I look forward to this interesting, enlivening discussion. How are you right now?
I'm fine, thanks. And you know what? I'd like to defer my statement until later because I'd like to get right into things. And maybe we should make it a closing statement. To wrap things up, I think would be a better thing to do. So why don't we just get right into the subject matter, because education is one of the most important issues that I think faces the District of Columbia right now. We need good neighborhood schools in every neighborhood, and there are many issues that revolve around getting good neighborhood schools, and I'd like to get questions from people so we can start asking them. Then I'll close with a statement. So, do we have any questions? Has anybody called in yet, Kathleen, or have they Skyped in some questions?
No, not at this moment, but I really want to ask you, let me have you speak on this question, Michael Brown. Let's see. You know, reading proficiency improvement is a goal of the chancellor's, right? And I don't see how this can happen without, like, an effective school library program. What are your thoughts on school libraries? You know, with all this technology and stuff, I've been wondering how it's going to impact schools, and if the schools are relying more on the social technology or social media than actual learning how to work in a library and do research. You know, what would your plans be for ensuring all schools are funded and staffed and supported with, you know, school library programs?
Well, I think that's a good question, and we really need to staff school libraries. I mean, since in the past 3 years, we've lost a third of all school librarians in the D.C. public school system, and this is just terrible. I mean, we're expecting kids to embrace all this new technology on their own, and I think that's just crazy. I think that every school needs to have a qualified library media specialist, and every school needs to be fully funded, because if kids could go on the internet and learn all this stuff on their own, they wouldn't even need schools. They could just stay at home and do this. So the idea of cutting these resources from the DC public schools for me is just crazy. And we need to fully fund every school with a library media specialist, not a volunteer or somebody that comes in part time who's not qualified and has a master's degree in library science. There's been an initiative put forth to do that in public schools, but as yet it hasn't been actualized. So one of the first things I would do on the city council is I would try to make sure that we get full funding for every school to do that. And so far, I haven't seen that accomplished. And I think it's one of the shortcomings of DCPS Central Office that they haven't actually actualized that plan yet. So I think that's a good question. I think we really have to do it.
Oh, well, that's fun. That's a good answer. We do have somebody that's called in. We have Peter McPherson, who is online, too. Mr. McPherson, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Oh, thank you for calling in. And I gather you have a question for Michael Brown.
Yes, Senator, I'm a Ward 6 education activist, and, you know, I think that... you know, we've spent, $1.5 billion on school modernization, but to me, that money has been spent very unevenly, and a lot of schools are still awaiting modernization and awaiting an adequate level of modernization as well. And I'm just wondering, you know, what your views are of the school modernization program, and if you perceive it to be equitable, and if you haven't, what steps should we take to bring more equity to it?
Well, that's a great question, Mr. McPherson, and I think that the schools that have been modernized, they've done a great job. Certainly, schools like Wilson High School and Eastern High School and the schools that I've seen that have come under the modernization plan have done they've done a great job, but the plan is slow, and certainly schools east of the river, they need to take it up a notch. You know, I know that they're working on Anacostia High School right now, but the plan needs to move forward at a faster rate, I believe. And I think that especially, again, with things like libraries. I know that the library at Walls, for example, was supposed to be modernized and hasn't been finished yet. So they need to pick up the pace on these things, because this is very important to students. You know, my kids, I'm sure that you've had children go through the school system as well, Mr. McPherson, and my kids, it seemed like just yesterday that they were in pre-K and now they're in college. So we really can't afford to wait on this stuff, because kids get left behind if we do that. And there's such an achievement gap between white students and black students, students east of the river and west of the river, poor students and rich kids, that we need to, or maybe not rich kids, but middle class kids, that we need to up our game as far as this goes. And I think the modernization plan is moving forward. It's great, but it's too slow, and we need to pick up the pace. And I think that the fact that we've given $500 million back to the taxpayers this year, taxpayers that make up to $1 million a year, was short-sighted. I think some of that should have been put into the school system because our school system is still failing miserably.
Can I amplify on what I asked? When I was about the sort of the equity question, I mean, we have schools like here in Ward 6, like Watkins Elementary School, that has 550 students. It's one of the largest elementary schools in the city. And, you know, ever since when the modernization plan was first articulated, when Michelle Rhee first came to Washington as chancellor, Watkins, and that's sort of my hobby horse at the moment, is the modernization of Watkins. But it has a, rated as being amongst the poorest condition. And, here we are. It's been put off twice, in spite of the fact that it has, was rated as being in amongst the poorest condition of schools, and also given the fact that it's one of the biggest elementary schools in the city with 550 kids. And next year, they're supposed to do, they do these phased modernizations for elementary schools, although if you live in Ward 3, that doesn't seem to apply. But next year, if you subtract the architect's fees, they're going to spend $11 million on that building. And now I realize the United States of America is the only country in the world where you get to say $11 million is not very much money. But in our context, $11 million is not very much money, especially considering the scope of the school's problems. And I'm just wondering, do you think that, that the money is there, that the money can be found? I mean, to really give these schools that have waited so long a proper level of modernization, not just dribbling in money?
No, I absolutely think the money's there. You know, we have a school budget that exceeds $800 million, so $11 million really isn't that much money. And Watkins is just one example of a school that is in desperate need of refurbishment and modernization. You know, the first time I'm almost embarrassed to say this, that the first time I ran for public office and went around to all the schools, I came across Knoll Elementary School, which is a polling place over in Ward 8, and it's over in Southwest. And I thought the school was closed. When I saw students coming out of it, I was amazed. I thought it had been a school that had been abandoned. So there are many schools in the District of Columbia and more elementary schools. I mean, you're absolutely right. Many of these elementary schools are in desperate need, and I think we have the money to do it. And as far as the schools in Ward 3 go, they waited too. I mean, my kids went to Janney Elementary School, one of the best schools in the city, and they waited for years and years to be modernized, and they had one bathroom, I think, for girls and one bathroom for boys when they had 400 students. They had an inadequate library. Again, libraries are so essential to the life of a school. And Wilson was the same way. I remember my kids being sent home because there were holes in the ceilings of Wilson High School and the rain was coming in. So they had to be sent home from school one day because they couldn't hold class. But now Wilson's beautiful. As I said, Eastern's beautiful. A lot of these schools, I think it's unfortunately gives you more political, clout to do a high school. People see high schools are somehow more visible, I think, politically. So they get the grease before the elementary schools. But it's important to do schools like Watkins. And, yeah, it's been put off twice, and that's we shouldn't do that, especially now that we have this new boundary plan where we're going to start shifting students around. We need to make sure we have good schools that tie into all these new feeder patterns before we start, adjusting students. We should be adjusting schools. So absolutely we have the money. Absolutely we should stop stalling on that. We need to get going with it. And thanks for that question.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
And is that your last question, Mr. McPherson?
Yeah, that does it for me.
All right. Thanks for calling and being concerned.
Thank you.
Okay.
And now we do have Rachel on line three.
Rachel, what's your question?
Hi. I went through D.C. public schools my whole life. I graduated from Wilson Senior High School, and I was wondering about the rapid growth of the charter schools in D.C. I was wondering if you thought they were a good thing or a bad thing. Like, going through Wilson, it was a fantastic school. I learned so much, and I just don't seem to understand why our charter schools are burgeoning these days.
Well, that's a good question, and I think that there's a lot to say about charter schools. First of all, they're here to stay, so we need to embrace them and do what we can to make them as good as possible. And one thing that we need to do with charters is to make sure they get more funding, because they're not adequately funded right now. But I think I hear in your question, the real question is, why is this happening? And I think to answer that question, it's happening because our regular public school system is failing. I mean, now Washington, D.C. has the highest number of charter schools in the country, with the exception of New Orleans and Philadelphia. And this is an indication that the traditional public schools are not working. If they were, there wouldn't be so many charter schools. And I think probably, I don't know how old you are, Rachel, when you went through high school, but we probably have a lot more charter schools than when you were in school. It's almost 50% of the students in the D.C. public school system. So the reason is our traditional public schools aren't working. But what we have to do is we have to embrace the charters. We have to make sure they're adequately funded. We also have to make sure that we're learning from each other. You know, there doesn't seem to be any coordination. There should be some monitoring of why people, you know, what kinds of kids are going to charter schools, changing from traditional public schools. And we should try to figure out what it is that charter schools are offering that the regular public schools aren't offering, and use that information to improve the traditional public DC public schools. I think that there's a lot to be gained from both of them, but it seems that we're on two separate tracks here, and I don't think that benefits the students in any way. I think we all have to be headed in the same direction on the same track. And I know that the Chancellor, Kyra Henderson, has talked about taking over the public the charter schools, being in charge of the charter schools. I don't necessarily think that's a good idea, but I think there should be a liaison between both the public and the charter schools to make sure that we're getting as much knowledge as we can out of both camps, and we're sharing information and making both sets of schools better. Thanks for your question. Anything else?
Great. Thank you. Nope, that's it.
Thank you. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you, Rachel, very much for calling. We appreciate that. You know, let me ask you something right now. As someone who is also a parent of kids, the one thing, why do you think charter schools, though, have taken off? Is it kind of something that's seen as a way to make money for those people who are opening the schools? And are they the same kind of qualified teachers that you would find in the public schools?
Well, you know, I mean, unfortunately, I think that's a good question, because lately we've had some scandals with charter schools where actually in one case the people that ran the charter school have misappropriated so much money that they're being criminally prosecuted right now. So there's certainly an element of that. But I think for the most part, it's just that people want to give their kids the best education. And when they see the public school failing, they have to realize that they have to look for an alternative, and charter schools are the alternative. But no, I don't think in some cases the teachers and administrators are at the same level in the public schools, because very often the people that are making decisions in charter schools are parents. And there's nothing wrong with parents being involved in the education system, but certainly we should leave much of the decision making to people that have been trained and have the experience to do that. So I think, as I said earlier, that there has to be an exchange between the traditional public schools and the charter schools so that we can learn from each other and we can use the expertise of both to make both stronger and better. Charter schools aren't going anywhere in the District of Columbia. There's a big fight over funding now, but and some of those questions need to be resolved, but they're not going anywhere and we need to accept them. And I think the reason we have so many of them is because our traditional public schools are failing and we need to up our game.
Well, that's very, very true. It's a sad state in many of the cities where you have such an inequality with, you know, the charter schools and the public schools. And, of course, the issue also is, you know, you don't have the situation where charter schools are moving into buildings where there are public schools also, do you, here in D.C.?
Oh, yeah, you do. You have charter schools taking over many public schools. And one problem that we have, actually, this is a problem with the new boundary plan. Maybe somebody will call in and ask about that because that's a big issue these days. But there's one actually in our neighborhood, an old middle school, which has been taken over by the lab school. And there's an elementary school down the street, which is just busting at the seams. And there's some talk among people about, you know, taking back the school and using it as a DC public school and moving the lab school maybe to another school, Georgetown Day School, which is also in the neighborhood, and vacating its facilities. Now, lab school is not a charter school, and it's a great school, so nobody wants to displace it. But, you know, we've been giving up a lot of, yes, traditional school buildings for charter schools, and there's more and more of that going on. And I think, again, it just comes down to coordination. Nobody wants to shut the charter schools out, but we also want to – we don't want to diminish the D.C. public schools either.
That's a good question. Now, I just got a question that was Skyped in from Lloyd. What are you doing to stop kids from dropping out of school? I understand that in some schools it is as high as 50%. These kids have no jobs. What are they supposed to do?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. Yes, in some schools, in Anacostia High School, it's almost 50%. In fact, 11 students drop out every school day in the district, and that's 2,000 students a year. And, of course, this is an issue that I really, really care about because, as you might know, my parents both passed away when I was a teenager, and in my acting out stage, I dropped out of high school. I never finished. Got an equivalency diploma, went back to school, worked my way through community college, and got a master's degree, and it changed my life. And these kids are ending up in a situation where their lives are being, you know, their futures are being truncated at 16 and 17 years old, and that's unacceptable. But to answer your question, what I think needs to be done, or to answer Lloyd's question, what needs to be done is that we need more counselors in these schools. We need more support services in schools, especially east of the river where we're having a terrible problem with this, because nobody drops out of high school because they can't handle the work. I didn't drop out of high school because I wasn't smart enough to finish. I graduated at the top of my class from a good university. The reason that I dropped out of high school is, I think, the reason that all kids drop out of high school, or the vast majority of them, is there's something else going on in our lives. So the first thing we need to do is we need to find out why kids are dropping out of high school. There shouldn't be one kid dropping out of high school who hasn't gone through a series of counseling and social services that have determined why that person is dropping out of high school and what we can do to keep them in high school. You know, these people, we end up paying for these kids one way or the other. If they don't go through high school, we end up paying for them down the road somewhere in additional social services or other things. So we really need to intervene early. It starts with truancy. You know, in some places in the District of Columbia, there's some high schools where chronic truancy is as much as 65%. So we need to intervene earlier with truants. We need to find out what's going on in their lives. We need more social service people connected to the district public school system. We need more counselors and more social workers that are actually in the schools helping these kids deal with whatever problem is causing them to drop out. It's not just a matter of grades or being too much work. It's usually something going on at home or something going on in their lives elsewhere that make them do this. And we're not addressing this problem. It's absolutely epidemic in the district school system.
We have Matt online, too. Matt, are you with us?
Sure am. Nice to talk with you, Michael.
Hey, Matt. How are you?
Very good. And yourself?
Good. Good. And so, go ahead.
So I heard you talking a little bit before about funding and charter school funding, and there's been the questions about the role of the charter schools. I'm curious because there's a place where there's an intersection between funding for schools and statehood issues that I think have been very important to you. And I'm curious, you may be aware that the American Association of Public Charter Schools and two charter schools in the district have brought a suit in federal court urging that a federal court mandate that the district only provide funding through the uniform per pupil funding formula. The idea is Congress, according to them, passed a law that said that's the way we fund schools, that's the way we fund DCPS, that's the way we fund charter schools, and the district must, going forward, fund schools in that way and only that way. The district has provided additional dollars to DCPS to meet perceived needs, like for maintenance, and as an example. And the charter schools are saying that because of the law that Congress passed, the district may not do that. And so I'm curious if you've looked at that lawsuit, if you have a reaction to that lawsuit, if you have an idea of how we might address whatever underlying issue is there different than in the lawsuit. I'm curious to hear your views on that, Michael.
Well, thanks, Matt. That's a great question. And of course, as somebody that's fought for the past 8 years to make the district independent of the federal government and make us, a state and thereby equal, I'm offended on one level by the lawsuit. I mean, we can't talk out of both sides of our mouth. We can't say that we deserve the same rights and equality as everybody else and that the federal government should stop interfering with our gun laws and stop interfering with our funding. This is a big issue for us. The fact that the Congress approves our budget every year, we start each school year. I mean, it affects everything, but the way it affects schools is we start each school year without having an approved budget, and that really handicaps us. And then on the other hand, go to them like Big Brother and say, look, we have this problem and only you can straighten it out. So on one level, it offends me. On another level, I think that it's just bad. It sets a bad precedent. You know, we're always fighting with the federal government over things that involve the schools. There's a scholarship program, for example, that members of Congress and actually the President of the United States decided that they wanted to fund in the District of Columbia. And the city council and voters in the District of Columbia were against continued funding. But in the end, the federal government got its way because the federal government always gets its way in the District of Columbia. So I think it sets a bad precedent for us to go to them and ask them to resolve this problem just because it may in fact seem the most expedient thing to do on behalf of the plaintiffs who want to get this done. Of course, Alice Rivlin, somebody who I just testified with the other day. We both testified in front of the United States Senate on the statehood bill, which now resides in the committee of the Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Government Affairs. We were both witnesses at the first hearing. Dr. Rivlin gave an eloquent defense of statehood for the District of Columbia so that we could be equal. But then I believe she's a party to this suit. And again, I think it sets a bad precedent. And I think that it's we can't speak out of both sides of our mouth when it comes to gaining equality and self-determination here in the district. Beyond that, as far as funding goes, I think you know, Matt, that the charter schools can be more selective. We've just had an issue where charter schools have now adopted new rules, just recently adopted new rules for expelling students because they didn't have the same guidelines that the DC public schools had. So they were able to get rid of school students more easily that they found either disruptive or, you know, weren't for one reason or another, weren't acceptable to them. DC public schools don't have that latitude. They need to take all students. So I think that there should be more equity in funding for charter schools, but I don't think the per pupil formula that we use for the DC public schools is the same formula we should use for charter schools, because charter schools have certain advantages that DC public schools don't have. So I think we have to work out a better system for funding charter schools, but I don't think the per pupil formula is the way to go. And I think that asking the federal government to intervene on behalf of the charter schools and take control away from the citizens of the District of Columbia is just ridiculous, and we shouldn't tolerate it.
Matt, did you have a follow-up question for Mr. Brown?
Well, I'll ask. It won't be a follow-up, but I'm happy to ask. I'll try one other question, and thank you for that, Michael.
Yeah.
Another thing that's come up in the course of the discussion already is the changes to the boundaries and feeders and student assignment policies. And you know, I served on that committee, so it's a little tricky to ask you this, but I'm curious. There's a proposal, there's a set of recommendations that were on the table. The mayor has embraced those recommendations. I think it's fair to say that no one thinks those recommendations are perfect, including probably every single member of the committee that tried to come up with a consensus around what we should be recommending. But now those things are out there, and the question for the city government is going to be, should they stand, or should they be changed in some way? Should they be delayed? What should we do on this issue of modifying the boundaries for the different schools and the feeder patterns? Should we think we're done? Should we think that there are more revisions that need to be made? Should we think that we need to start over from square one? I'm curious what your reaction on that is.
Well, first of all, let me say, Matt, that you worked very hard on it, and several other people in the community worked hard on it, and I think you came up with a good, solid plan. That's the first thing. I know that the mayoral candidates are split on this. We have one mayoral candidate that says it's not going to be implemented. We've got another one that says we should wait. And then we have the mayor saying we should go ahead. So there's a lot of controversy over this. But I think the plan itself is solid to begin with. I think after 40 years of not having a plan, we needed a plan. I think you guys have just taken something that is just, I don't even know what to call it, a political octopus, because there were so many things that went into the mix of this. It was just I admire your bravery for even standing up and tackling a feat with this many political interests. I think you did an excellent job. I do think it needs to be tweaked. And I think that, excuse me, I'm getting a little hoarse. I think that there's several things that we need to do, just minor things that need to be addressed. The Crestwood problem of people that were in the feeder pattern to Wilson and Deal, or Wilson High School, and now have been changed to Roosevelt, are upset about, and I understand that. I live in AU Park. My wife and I bought our house when we had our first child, and part of our decision to buy here was because we're in the Janney, Deal, Wilson feeder pattern. So I certainly appreciate the way they feel, and I think we need to revisit that a little bit and allow them to have some input. I know that this isn't going to happen immediately, and I think that was a good compromise, but I think there's some other things that we need to do as far as making those people feel secure that their kids are still going to get a good education. And I think there are other things other little tweaks that need to be done. But the only thing that really the big issue that bothers me about the new boundary plan is that I'm a little bit fearful that it's putting the cart before the horse. I think we need to fix the schools. I don't think we can ask people to send their kids to lower performing schools. And I think we need to step up our effort to fix the schools while we implement the new feeder plan. I think that I've looked at the feeder plan. I know that if your kids are already in a school, that they can stay there. I know that it's not going to be implemented overnight. And what I would say is I'd like to see it implemented, but I'd like to see it tweaked a little bit, and I'd like to see us put a real effort into fixing the schools that have been ignored for too long. And there's a lot of them in the District of Columbia. As you well know, the schools in our neighborhood are great. Our kids went to Janney Elementary School, Deal, Wilson. They're all good, solid schools. A lot of that has to do with the fact that the parents are very much involved. Parents like you, Matt, who are very much involved in the schools and help them make them a better place. And I think we all have to get involved, and we have the responsibility to make other schools in the system to straighten out some of the problems as we implement the new feeder plan. Muriel Bowser has committed to opening new middle schools in areas that have been underserved for a long time. I think this is a positive thing, and I think we need to continue our work on the schools as we implement the feeder plan. So I'm not trying to dodge the question here. So let me sum up and just say, yes, I think it's a good, solid plan. I also think it needs to be tweaked a little bit, but it needs to be implemented, and we need to step up our efforts to fix the schools before we start shifting everybody around dramatically.
Well, thanks for that, Michael.
Thank you, Matt. Thanks for calling in, and thanks for all your hard work.
Yes, thank you, Matt. We do have another question that was Skyped in from Alicia, and it is, Muriel Bowser has committed to keeping Kaya Henderson as the school chancellor if she gets elected. What do you think of this? Is she right to do that?
Well, you know, I support Muriel Bowser, and I'm not sure whether or not we should keep Chancellor Henderson, to tell you the truth. But our school system is obviously failing. And I think to commit to keep her at this point is premature. I think that I know why she did it. She said she wanted to do it for consistency. But I guess I'm a little perplexed at the idea that you want consistency in a school system that's not working. We obviously have to make adjustments in our school system. And So I think it's premature to say that you want to keep her. I mean, it, to me, it seems a little bit like committing to for the White Star Line to commit to keep the navigator of the Titanic because they want to consistency in their transportation line. It doesn't make sense to me. We're really headed in the wrong direction in a lot of ways in the school system. And I know that, excuse me, that candidate Bowser, Councilwoman Bowser, said that she met with Chancellor Henderson and that she's confident that her vision for the school system is the same as Muriel's is, Muriel Bowser's, but she hasn't articulated the specifics of that. And I think if you're going to commit to keep the new chancellor or to keep the chancellor as the new mayor, that you should articulate what those visions are so that the public can decide whether that's an appropriate thing to do or not. And I think that she was premature in saying that she would keep her, and I think she should wait until she was elected, and we should look at what the options are.
How long is Ms. Henderson been in the office?
She's been in the office for about 4 years, not quite 4 years. She was the assistant to Michelle Rhee, who left right after Mayor Gray was elected. So she probably left in February or March. I can't remember exactly, but she's coming up to 4 years in the school system. And I'll tell you, we've had slight increases in math and reading scores among elementary school students. But beyond that, I really haven't seen great improvement in our school system. And I think there's some tough questions that need to be asked. I don't necessarily think that we should rest the blame at the door of the chancellor. Totally rest the blame there, but you know, I think the duty of a leader is to lead, and I'm not sure that she's done the best job in leadership, and I think that at least needs to be questioned. Whether or not we take action is another thing, but I think it at least needs to be questioned. And I know that David Catania, who's the other mayoral candidate and has kind of spearheaded the Committee on Education for the Council, has asked some tough questions, and I'm not sure they've all been answered yet. So, again, I would say in the end that we should review carefully, because this is such an important issue for the District of Columbia. You know, we spend more money than almost any jurisdiction in America per student, and I think we're ranked 48th or 49th. Among the states in education. That's just terrible. We're the most educated city in America. There is no, in fact, in the world, there's no city in the world where more people have graduate degrees than the District of Columbia. This is, in that sense, the most educated city in the world. Yet, a third of our population is illiterate. They can't read. They're functionally illiterate. They can't read the newspaper. This is a disgrace. The achievement gap between rich students and white, or middle class students, white students and black students, is just a national disgrace. And we keep on talking about minor increases in reading and math scores, but it seems to me we're missing the forest for the trees.
Well, we do have another caller who wants to stay anonymous on line two. Are you with us, caller?
Yes, I am. I have a question for you. I am a teacher in DCPS, and I have, over the past, you know, since Michelle Rhee came along, the classroom environment has moved to one of heavy testing between the Common Core and then the Impact tool, which leans heavily on student test scores. I think that we are taking the teaching out of teaching, and it puts way too much weight on the testing. So I wanted to know what your thoughts are about the current classroom environment where testing takes precedence both for students and teachers?
Well, that's a good question. You know, and I think it flows really from what I was saying earlier about what's going on in the school system. Testing, first of all kind of standardized testing is static, and I think that that's a problem that you have with it. I think that you know, when you look at some, you're trying to be objective and put forth a criteria, a standard, which brings people to a certain level, and this is certainly part of the Common Core. Unfortunately, you're not rating improvement, and I think that's that's a much more important measure. How far have students come, rather than are they all learning at the same level? So that's one problem you have with testing in general. I think this, as teachers go, and I would say when you talk, by the way, I don't mean to digress here, but when you talk about keeping Chancellor Henderson, I think the teachers have a different attitude about this than the some of the parents have. I think that if you ask teachers whether you should keep her, I'm not sure that they would have the same attitude. But I digress. So let me get back to the question. I think that you need to really test student growth rather than just proficiency. This is a problem with the Common Core. It's not tied to any particular curriculum. We just say, this is the standard you should reach. This is how proficient you should be. Then we leave it up to the school system or the schools or the teachers to decide what the curriculum should be to get students to that level. And I think that's another problem with it. And it uses students as guinea pigs. You know, some students, again, the Common Core, some students go down one track and some students go down another, and then when they converge, let's say they leave middle school and go on to high school, they're expected to be at the same level, and they may have gone through all sorts of different types of teaching until they've gotten to that point. So those are problems that I have with standardized testing in the Common Core. Now, the impact tool that's used to judge teachers, one thing is it's too subjective. I think that, it relies heavily on student test scores. And I don't think, again, for the reasons I've just outlined with standardized testing, that can be the primary measure of whether you have a good teacher or a bad teacher. You know, there's one thing to provide information, and it's another thing to teach students. We all remember the good teachers that we had in school, growing up and in college, the good professors we had. And we know that many times those people were not didn't teach in an orthodox method. Sometimes they were unorthodox. Sometimes they were just inspiring, and they challenged us to learn rather than just give us the facts. So I think that the impact tool doesn't take into account different types of teaching styles because it uses, you know, the standard, the scores of students to decide whether you're doing a good job or not. And actually, again, doesn't judge student growth, but rather just student proficiency. Also, I think that we leave too much to the principals and the other people that are involved in doing the rating. There's more than two dozen categories inside the public school system that principals have to rate teachers, social workers, counselors, I mean, gym teachers, janitors, you go on and on, librarians, all these different types of people. I think it's too subjective to allow principals who may not be trained. I mean, how does a principal may be well qualified to determine whether a teacher is doing the right job. But does he have the same qualifications or she have the same qualifications to judge a counselor or a social worker that works in the school or a librarian? I mean, sometimes it seems to me that these ratings are probably done on personality rather than proficiency. And I know teachers, I've heard from teachers, I know they're upset about it, and I think they have every right to be. So I think we need to question the impact tool, and we need to look at it more carefully before we use it. We shouldn't use it as a weapon against our teachers. We actually should use it to enhance the school system and their ability to teach, and sometimes I don't think we do that. And the Common Core, I think that it shouldn't be the rule that we all live by. I know that Bill Gates loves it, and I know there are other educators. My brother's the president of a college, and he thinks it's a great idea. So I know there are a lot of well-educated, well-intentioned people that think that it really should be the standard, but I question sometimes what it does to students and why we haven't been able to develop a curriculum around it, which deals with all subject matters. We've been kind of phasing in one piece of the curriculum after another, and I think we need to move on that quicker if we're going to use it as a standard. Because as I said earlier, my kids were in pre-K the last time I took a look, and now they're in college. So we can't sacrifice the thousands of students that will go through the school system to the Common Core because we don't have it together.
Well, I also think, it's very interesting as this Common Core is spread throughout the United States, it really hasn't been tested. But, one of the things as a parent, I think I have a lot of concern with the Common Core, is just that they don't even teach how to write, how to do cursive. And there seems so many things that are being left to just go for this high-stakes testing. Do you have a stand on where you are with high-stakes testing?
Do I have a stand on where I am on high-stakes testing? Yeah, I don't think it should be the end-all, be-all. I think that, that we need to test, we need a measure, but I think we put way too much weight on it. I honestly do. And I think that, yes, some of the basic things that they've eliminated, like teaching cursive writing, I think is not appropriate. And I think that we rely too heavily on it. So that's the way I feel about that. And I think you're right. I think we're too dependent on it all the way around. And I think, I also worry that we do it in the name of corporate America more than we do it in the name of better students. I think it's, that's a real concern too.
Well, thank you, Michael, for, having this type of, I think it's kind of a new program or a new thing that we've tried to do to get people to call in on different subjects, because as you know, when you go to forums and with as many candidates as there are, it's very hard to answer questions of the people, and we hope that this is something new and different and can involve people in the whole election process. So we have, unfortunately, we have reached our time limit, and we are going to be, closing. And do you have anything that you would like to say?
Yes, I'd like to make a closing statement. First of all, I want to apologize to people. We were a little rough. This is our first of five forums, which Kathleen will probably tell you about in a minute, but was a little rough at the beginning. So I'd like to read my opening statement, which I've now made my closing statement. Every neighborhood deserves successful schools. We can hardly laud the success of students who make small gains in reading and mathematics when 11 students drop out of school, the school system every day in the district. We lose over 2,000 kids a year whose futures are truncated and their prospects become limited. Without adequate education, many of these children end up being a burden on the resources of our city rather than the asset they could be if they had a proper education and a chance at a good paying job with a bright future. In addition to the alarming dropout rate, school truancy is an all-time high, and the achievement gap between white and black students is a disgrace. DC public schools are not preparing our children for the future, and this is evidenced not only by the increasing dropout and truancy, but also by skyrocketing rise in public charter schools. Washington, D.C., as I said before, is now the leading the country in the creation of new charter schools, behind only New Orleans, which is a system solely comprised of charter schools as a result of the devastation of Hurricane Katrina, and Philadelphia, which is only slightly ahead of the district. This is a sign that our traditional public schools are failing. In addition, we're failing our public charter schools as well by denying them adequate funding. We need a system that embraces both and provides adequate funding and develops successful schools in every neighborhood. We need to provide additional support services for disadvantaged students by increasing the number of counselors for kids who are at high risk and adding solid after-school programs and extracurricular activities that build strong school communities. In addition, we need to provide more vocational and technical training with better early intervention for chronic truants and students with problems. Each middle and high school should have an ombudsman to intervene as an advocate for students and parents and provide important feedback to central offices with problems. A good education provides children with a solid foundation for success, and we need to develop these for a school system that's moving in the right direction. The current public school administration is too heavy, with emphasis on being placed on the wrong instructional model. For example, as we enter the age of exploding technology, as we said, we've cut instructional and support resources for librarians. We need to change that. Every school should have a qualified media library specialist. You cannot simply replace educators with technology and expect a good result. Adaptive learning can certainly be a useful tool if children could learn without the nurturing and guidance of trained professionals. They wouldn't even need schools. The new proposed changes to the school boundaries in some cases ignore the importance and vibrance of the well-being of schools to our neighborhoods, and they need some tweaking. So in the end, I think we need to build better schools in every community, more coordination between public and charter schools, embrace a new instructional model which not only accommodates new technology but provides students with the guidance, resources, and instruction which will enable them to succeed in an ever-changing and increasingly demanding world. It's time to rethink the direction of our public school system. It's time for successful schools in every neighborhood with successful outcomes for every child. Thank you.
Well, that was Michael D. Brown. He's running for D.C. Council at Large. And I'd just like to make it inform the audience that we are going to have four more of these town hall meetings. They will be every Sunday at 2 p.m. on bbsradio.com. And you can call in with your questions to 888-429-5471 or Skype us during our broadcast at BBS Radio 2. And you can also go to the website ahead of time, and it's www.michaeldbrown2014.com with any questions that you may have for the upcoming ones. Now, on September the 28th at 2 p.m., we will be having the town hall meeting on affordable, sustainable growth. October 5th at 2 p.m., jobs and a living wage. October 12th, 2 p.m., honest government and statehood. And then October 19th will be an open forum for any questions that you may have that we weren't able to cover, or any other follow-up questions that you have after listening to the town hall meetings. So we really appreciate it. I would like to also read a disclaimer. This program was paid for by Michael D. Brown for Council 2014. Patricia E. Brown is treasurer, 4501 Western Avenue Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20016. A copy of the finance report is on file with the Director of the Office of Campaign Finance for the District of Columbia. This program was produced by BBS Radio, all rights reserved. Again, we'd like to thank the audience, for all those who called in, for all those who are listening. We want to thank you for participating in this first town hall meeting, and we look forward to listening and hearing from you on the next four ones, every Sunday, 2 p.m. Again, thank you.